Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
What is the perfect story? Does it exist? Is there a tangible formula? Has the perfect story ever been told? And if so, are we simply trying to retell this story over and over? This podcast is called The Midnight Myth. And somewhere between the black of night and the break of dawn, there is a story, and it's perfect. My name is Derek Jones.
And my name is Laurel Hostack.
Welcome to The Midnight Myth. Welcome back to The Midnight Myth, everybody's favorite history, mythology, philosophy, and how those subjects bubble up into our popular storytelling podcast. As always, I am very excited to be back with another Midnight Myth. We are continuing our conversation on the Harry Potter film franchise. We are in year three of Hogwarts. It's time to get a little demented up in here. It's time to be a little animagus-y, a little werewolf-y, a little lupin-y, because we are doing Prisoner of Azkaban.
Excellent, excellent intro there. Yes.
You can tell I'm excited, right?
Yeah, yeah. And you have every reason to be excited. This is one of the most beloved installments of the film franchise for very, very good reason. Yeah, we're getting ready to learn some more advanced magic. We're getting a little bit darker in tone, and we are opening up an entire new world of possibilities within the exciting possibilities of the wizarding world we've already seen. So I'm just as excited as you are to take this one on.
Yeah, absolutely. And we also learned that there are people worse to Harry Potter than the Dursleys as we meet Harry's aunt. And we get to see the minister in magic in full force. We get hippogriffs. And we have so much to talk about. I don't even know if we're going to get to anything. A few quick just preambles before we get too deep into this episode. We actually talked about Prisoner of Azkaban quite extensively in a previous episode. It was episode 72?
I think it was 74. The episode is called Dementor. And yeah, so we did primarily focus on Prisoner of Azkaban through that episode, but the major focus of that was let's look at the role of mentors in storytelling. So if you want to get a little bit of a primer on some of the things we won't touch on in this episode, that one is mostly focused on the relationship between Harry Potter and Remus Lupin as a mentor-mentee relationship and some of the moral philosophy in the Harry Potter universe. We touch on a few other things in Azkaban as well, and we're going to try not to retread any of that ground in this episode. But the fortunate thing is, there is so much in Prisoner of Azkaban. I think it's one of the most mythologically rich in folklore, and also one of the more philosophically rich, for lack of a better term. It opens up so many questions for us as far as the installments of the Harry Potter series go, and it just gives us so much to mine. So I don't think we'll have any problem repeating ourselves.
Yeah, the other thing we talk about at length is the symbolism of the Dementor. We link it to the Wraith, and we apply the philosophy of natural law to whether it's right or wrong for the Minister of Magic to deploy mentors as a criminal justice wing of the wizarding world. And we quite emphatically condemned them from doing it, which we learn later in the books. You don't see this in the movies, that Dumbledore tries to convince the Minister of Magic to not use Dementors because they will be the first to go to Voldemort's side. spoiler alert, that totally happens. But in any event, we've got a lot to do. We've got a lot to cover here with Prisoner of Azkaban. We're not going to tread over the things we've already talked about. We have a whole new conversation around it. And as always, these conversations are never exhaustive. They never start or begin here on the podcast. So, you know, hit us up on Twitter if you have any thoughts. But we have also, Laurel, do your thing.
Yeah. So like you said, Derek, we would love to dialogue with you. If you want to hit us up on Twitter, we're at The Midnight Myth. We're on Facebook and Instagram at Midnight Myth Podcast. For the next 2 months, as we are going through the 8 films in the Harry Potter franchise, we are going to be donating our Patreon proceeds to the Transgender Law Center. So as always, thank you so much for supporting us on Patreon if you already are. And if you want to start supporting us on Patreon this month and next month, know that that's where your dollars are going. They are going to legal help for trans people across the world. So with that said, I say we jump in.
Yeah, just to reiterate, we believe in trans rights, unlike the author of Prisoner of Azkaban.
Yep, trans women are women, trans men are men, trans rights are human rights. It's that simple. We stand with our trans brothers and sisters, siblings. We love you.
So let's do the briefest of brief recaps. Man, these Harry Potter movies are not easy to recap because so much happens. This is Harry Potter's third year at Hogwarts. The movie begins with him still under the cruel parentage of the Dursleys, and we are introduced to Vernon Dursley's sister, who's by far the worst of all the Dursleys, and instantly starts berating, bossing, and smearing the memory of Harry's parents. Harry obviously loses his cool and blows her up into a balloon in one of the most funny and hilarious scenes in the entire movie, prompting Harry to want to leave the Dursleys for good. This is when he gets picked up by the night bus and learns of a murderer has escaped from Azkaban prison. Sirius Black, who is to date still a supporter of Voldemort and presumably has escaped to enact Voldemort's evil will. Harry then makes his way to the Leaky Cauldron, where he learns that Sirius Black is actually trying to kill Harry Potter. On the train to Hogwarts, we finally meet Professor R.J. Lupin, who's going to be the new Defense Against the Dark Arts teacher. And we see our first look at the Dementors, the wraith-like creatures employed by the Minister of Magic to torture and suck the souls of prisoners in Azkaban. And they are now being deployed to find and hunt down Sirius Black. The Dementors seem to have an unnatural and deadly effect on Harry as he faints, hearing his mother scream before he does. This is when Lupin shakes the Dementor away and then finally make it to Hogwarts. What follows is what starts as, like most of these movies, a typical year until they find out that Sirius Black has escaped into the castle and is hunting Harry. We also learn that Sirius Black is Harry's godfather and was responsible for Lord Voldemort having found Harry's home in Godric Hollow and is responsible for Voldemort having killed Harry's parents. Harry then vows to kill Sirius Black if he can. This is all happening while Hagrid becomes the new magical creatures teacher and introduces the kids to a thing called a hippogriff, who gets sentenced to death after breaking Malfoy's arm in his first lesson. Long story short, all of this culminates when Harry and Ron and Hermione go into the Shrieking Shack and confront Sirius Black, only to find out that Sirius is not trying to kill Harry Potter, but instead Ron's rat Scabbers, who turns out to be the thought-dead Peter Pettigrew, the actual person responsible for having given Voldemort's, or giving James and Lily Potter's location to Lord Voldemort. We also learn that Lupin is a werewolf, and a full moon comes, and he turns into a wolf, allowing Peter Pettigrew to escape. And Harry and Hermione and Sirius almost succumb to the Dementor's kiss when a magic Patronus, the charm which repels the Dementors, suddenly appears. This is when we learn that, God, so much happens in this movie.
Yeah, rewind.
This is where we learn that Hermione has been using a device called a time turner to be in two places at once by traveling back in time so she can obviously take more classes than what would be humanly possible. And Ron and, or not Ron, pardon me, Harry and Hermione go back in time, save Buckbeak, and break Sirius Black out of prison. At the very end of the movie, we see Harry and Lupin in the Defense Against the Dark Arts classroom, and Harry asks, didn't matter. Did any of this matter? Sirius is still considered a murderer? Nothing's really changed, in which Lupin says, no, it made all the difference in the world because you now know the truth. So do I, and so does Dumbledore. And then Harry gets a surprise gift from his new godfather, Sirius, a firebolt, the fastest broom in the world, and he takes off, ending the movie.
Well done, Derek. Well done. Really excellent recap there. I can't believe how much happens in this movie, too. Like, you get to the end of the sequence with the Dementors at the lake, and then you're like, okay, let's rewind and do the last act of this movie again, but do it from a different perspective. It's pretty amazing just how much they pack into it. So well done.
Yeah. I mean, I didn't even mention divination classes.
Oh, I know. Yeah.
And Sybil and, oh my God, so much happens in this movie. So first question, we've asked this in the previous two. Harry Potter and the Prisoner of Azkaban has been out since the early 2000s. We've just recently rewatched it in preparation for the pod. Does it hold up?
Oh my God, yes. You know, we're coming off the first two, Sorcerers in Chamber, which were both directed by Chris Columbus. And we talked about how much we think Chamber improves on the formula that Chris Columbus set out in the first installment. But from Chamber to Azkaban, there's just no comparison. And you bring on a master director like Alfonso Cuarón, and you just have a totally different product that nevertheless feels so true to the spirit of the source material. Like, the balance that he's able to strike between the absolute weirdness and whimsy of the books, which you see in the blowing up Aunt Marge scene and the night bus, and the darker tones, he's able to completely reshape the Hogwarts landscape, texture everything, texture the performances, texture the scenes. The cinematographic aspect of it is just, it's a totally new level. And I just have to throw tons of love on Alfonso Cuarón because he made one of my favorite movies of all time, A Little Princess. And so he has this incredible history of making films for young people that are not dumbed down cinematically, that are full of magic and whimsy and emotion and humor, and just touch all of those incredibly human aspects. He brings so, so much to this adaptation of it. And the story itself is just so excellent. It's just so emotional. I think it just takes the whole series to another level.
Yeah, after I saw Chamber of Secrets in the theater, I was a little kind of bored with the Harry Potter franchise. I thought the first movie I was completely charmed and delighted by. I thought it was amazing. I hadn't read any of the books. Then the second installment, I'm like, okay, it's pretty much just like the first movie again. I thought it was a good movie, but was like, yeah, I'm not too invested. And then when I saw the trailer for Prisoner of Azkaban, and this is before we were all super dialed in and every single detail of a movie was leaked online before it came out. And I just saw the trailer and I'm like, interesting. And I had heard they had gotten a new director. I had no idea who Alfonso Cuarón was. This was my introduction to him as a filmmaker. And I'm like, oh, it's going to be a little darker, a little grittier. All right, I'll check it out. And this movie saved me as a Harry Potter fan. I was 100% bought in after this one. I loved this movie from the first viewing. I love it to date. It is definitely my favorite of the movies, hands down. And I think that's because, I mean, to echo your sentiments, Alfonso Cuarón is a master filmmaker, and he kind of uses the camera as a character that speaks in a cinematic language that is impossible to mistake and singularly unique.
Super intentional, super purposeful, yeah.
And some things about this movie that I think it improves upon in the cinematic language it uses. One, Hogwarts feels textured and it feels large. It feels larger in the other installments, and you can feel every nook and cranny as if Hogwarts is a living, breathing organism itself.
Yeah, and you can feel how every aspect of it is connected, too, in ways that the movies didn't before. They were these isolated locations. Now you can see where everything leads into everything else.
And I think the children actors are finally allowed to be children. Even though this movie is darker, you get scenes of them laughing, you get scenes of them joking around. They look like I would imagine kids at a wizard school would look. Their ties aren't perfectly tied. Alfonso Cuarón told them to wear the clothes in the way that makes you feel the most comfortable, to make the children look comfortable, and they act more comfortably as a result of this. So it feels like a real place. You get a size and scope of it. You get the textures. The way that he plays with light and darkness from the very first shot with Harry failing to do the Lumos Maximus spell and the way that these scenes transition using light and dark is huge. And it's about the conflict of good magic and dark magic happening. And then there is the way that he uses reflection in glass.
Yeah.
That is so phenomenal. I mean, everyone talks about, if you do any sort of Harry Potter film studies, everyone talks about the scene with the Boggart and the way the camera goes in and out of the mirror. But the entire movie plays with this motif where Harry is constantly near or by a piece of glass and the camera moves through it. And then when they go back in time, the camera magically moves through a clock through what? A piece of glass. This to me calls echoes of the movie is asking Harry and asking us to look within ourselves, to be introspective, to meditate on what it means to be a magical person in this world and what it means to be a fan of a magical person in this world. These themes get echoed as we learn that Remus Lupin has a deadly and terrible disorder called lycanthropy, which is treated more like a disease and a condition than a monstrous curse that it does in other werewolf narratives. We learn that things aren't what they seem. A rat can actually be a servant of Voldemort in disguise. Sirius Black, the escaped murderer, can be innocent. We see all of these things asking us to look within ourselves and to really ask these deep and fundamental questions of where are we? What is this? What is happening? Are people who are using power, are they using it justly? Or are they using it cruelly? Could there be a well-intended bureaucrat like Fudge who means well, who wants the wizarding world to be profitable and safe, who wants to protect people like Harry Potter, but uses Dementors to hunt down an innocent man? And can people like the Malfoys use their authority to get an innocent hippogriff put to death because a child got hurt because he didn't listen to the lessons of his professor? And all of these questions come, and they're all fundamentally introspective. And the way Alfonso Cuarón uses reflection, mirror, and glass echoes that theme. And it's unique in the Harry Potter movies.
That's really well said. You know, it's also asking us, it's evolving questions that it laid out in the earlier installments, like what are your deepest desires? Instead, it's asking, what are your deepest fears? And why do you fear those things? And are those fears actually rational? How do we overcome those fears? I also think it's the first installment of the series that like genuinely starts to engage with trauma, which will become more and more important later. I think it will become most important in Order of the Phoenix. But it starts to introduce the idea that Harry is a character living with deep trauma and manifesting what that would look like if it were, possible to realize that through magic and possible to overcome that through magic, especially with the Patronus charm. So, yeah, I agree with everything you're saying. The camera as a character, the impossible camera, the texture of the grounds, the expansion of the world, and the use of every visual symbol to link to something that is character-based is really, really important in this installment, and it's just excellent.
Yeah, and I really think this is the movie where our three child actors take huge steps forward in their acting ability, and I definitely credit Alfonso Cuarón's direction and making them look, feel, and sound like children in a dangerous adventure. And that's something that the other two movies didn't quite get as well. And I think even going forward, you know, Alfonso Cuarón's the best director who has touched a Harry Potter franchise. Would you agree?
I would agree. I do think that once they get David Yates on board, they really do establish a very, this is what Harry Potter movies look like now kind of style. And they are very successful in the later installments. But I think this one is kind of singular in its impact. And I'd be so curious to see his take on the entire series. I'd be so, so curious to see what he did there. Can I also say just the casting of the new adult characters, too, is inspired. Like, bringing on David Thewlis as Remus Lupin, bringing on Gary Oldman, the great Gary Oldman, as Sirius Black, and Timothy Spall as Wormtail, these characters who are going to continue throughout the series and who work together with the great Alan Rickman, in this incredible just display of English and British actors. Like, it's, I just applaud the casting directors here.
Let us not forget Sybil Trelawney.
Oh my God, Emma Thompson is in this movie. So we have spent how much time gushing now about like the incredible choices made in this movie, but hopefully you agree with us and you can understand the kind of incredible reverence that we have for it.
Yeah, we agree that this movie holds up. I think the only thing, if we're going to be critical, that doesn't look fantastic at this point later in the game, that hasn't aged as well, is the werewolf CGI isn't bad, but it's not stellar.
Yeah, it's not outstanding. And like, I think the design is kind of almost there. I usually don't like werewolf design in movies for the most part. And I think that like the art direction got a really interesting concept. It's just not fully rendered to total mind-blowing effect.
But you know, Buckbeak is a marvel of special effects,
yeah.
of digital special effects, and looks, sounds, and feels so real. The Animagus effects totally hold up. The Sirius as a dog, the Pettigrew as a rat, and their changes are really great. That's the one area, if I'm being nitpicky, that say that I don't think holds up as well. It in no way affects my pleasure or love of this movie, though.
Agreed.
All right, so let us, now we agree, it holds up. We've recapped it. Let us turn our eye to analysis here. Where would you like to begin? And I know it held up, touched a little analysis, but I do think there are some interesting symbols that we can mine from this movie. And so, Laurel, where would you like to begin in that?
Well, yeah, there's so many places that we could begin, but for me, on this watch through, the place that I found the most interesting riches was to look at the well of animal magic that is introduced to us through the Prisoner of Azkaban, because animals and creatures have been important throughout the series so far, and they will continue to be important, but I think it's in this installment where we get the most in-depth understanding of how animals and the natural world are connected in with the wizarding world. So I would love to talk about the kind of three aspects of animal magic that we explore throughout The Prisoner of Azkaban, if that's okay with you.
I love it.
So Derek, would you agree that there's comparatively a lot of dogs in this movie?
Yes, there are.
Like, there's a dog in the first scene, there's a bulldog, and like, then there's a werewolf, and then there's the Grimm. Like, there's a lot of dog imagery in this. And that's not the only animal imagery we get. We obviously get a lengthy exchange between a cat owner and a rat owner. So there's certainly tons of animal imagery, but I think the dog is clearly the overarching, like, biggest animal symbol that we see in the movie. And I think it's worth looking kind of at the mythological and the folkloric connections of the different introductions of the dog throughout this to understand why the canine is so so central to Prisoner of Azkaban. Because on the one hand, we have the werewolf, right, which is a universally known mythological symbol. That's the man who transforms into a wolf around the full moon, loses control, and becomes a feral beast, but then wakes up the next day and is a man again. As Hermione puts this in the Defense Against the Dark Arts lesson, where Snape is filling in for Lupin while he's mysteriously missing around the full moon, the werewolf has no choice. Whereas we are also introduced to the Animagus, another form of animal transformation where someone can elect to turn into an animal as a form of taking power over that animal's abilities. So we have this first introduction of a condition, like you called it earlier, lycanthropy. We get the term lycanthropy from lycos, which is the Latin word for wolf. And the werewolf goes back to the ancient world. One of the earliest attestations that we have of the werewolf is in Ovid, in the story of Lycanos, who was punished by the gods for consuming human meat, usually the meat of his own sons, by being transformed into a wolf. So it was a punishment. And pretty much every culture has a werewolf adjacent story. If you had wolves in your country geographically, you probably have some folklore or mythology about men being transformed into wolves. There are even some scholars who believe that the earliest writings about werewolf transformations are in the Epic of Gilgamesh. So as early as, you know, writing, as early as things are being written down, people are writing about transformation into wolves. And I think one of the things that this taps into the most clearly, especially when we're looking at the symbolism of the dog, is the beast-like aspect of human nature, right? So we're looking inward introspectively, like you were saying at the top of the episode, and saying there is an inner sort of feral nature to man that cannot always be controlled. And once that is unleashed, we have this incredible beast. We have something that is totally out of our control. And we can see the toll that that takes on Remus Lupin, who is a good man, who has good intentions, wants to do good things, wants to teach, wants to impart wisdom, wants to help Harry and his fellow students overcome their deepest fears, but who is being ravaged from the inside out by his, tormented inner nature. And even though, you know, when he's not in wolf form, he is essentially benevolent, we even see a bloodthirst surface in him by the end of the story. We see him wanting to kill Peter Pettigrew, wanting to enact harm on Peter Pettigrew. And I think that is clearly some of the wolf aspect of him, some of the beastly, uncontrolled aspect of him that is emotional and that is not aligned with the inner logic that we have come to expect from the character.
Yeah, I love all of that. That's really interesting. Can I add another aspect to the werewolf mythology?
Yeah, please.
It's also deeply linked with the cycles of the moon.
Yeah.
Which is to say that the werewolf and the werewolf behavior is a predictable pattern, one that you can foresee based upon the alignments of celestial objects. This is also another theme in this movie, which is divination. And we can see and know when a werewolf will become a werewolf because of the connection, in particular, that ancient people felt to the celestial objects. They didn't know what they were or how they did or didn't affect human behavior. And so when what stepped in then were myths and legends, and the fact that the werewolf is linked to the lunar cycle, you know, people intuitively saw animals could behave differently, tides could behave differently, depending upon where the moon was. They didn't know what gravity was and its effect on the planet. And so they recognized the innate power of the moon and assumed it would also have some effect on humanity.
Yeah, well, you get the term lunacy and lunatic from the effects of the moon. So people going a little bit crazy or a little bit wild or losing a little bit of control underneath the full moon gets associated with things like lunacy.
And even to date, when you're having a bizarre and strange day interacting with people you didn't even think possible, you always tend to look at your friends or coworkers and say, is today a full moon?
Is there a full moon tonight? Because, people are acting kind of strange.
Because things are getting weird, man.
Yeah.
Even to date, that tradition survives into modernity, into our era in that phrase, because we recognize that long tradition of having a relationship with celestial objects and using celestial objects to be a predictor of human behavior, to divine things that could happen. And the werewolf lives in that legacy, which is no surprise that we get a werewolf right when the students are starting to learn divination.
Yeah, no, I think that's a really good point that you're bringing up. You know, the one aspect of the werewolf that doesn't necessarily exert a lot of force over the Harry Potter series, because these are still for young people, is that it is also deeply sexual in nature. The idea that man's inner nature is feral, man's inner nature is wild, is often equated with a sort of sexual deviancy. And that can often be linked with the lunar cycle as well, which usually represents a feminine aspect to the more masculine sun. So that doesn't necessarily exert a ton of influence over Harry Potter, but it is something interesting to note as we're talking about the effects of the moon on the cycles of human nature. The other aspect of the dog that we get in this story, though, is through Sirius, who is this second form of animal magic, the animagus or animagus. This is someone who elects to turn into an animal. And we don't get all of the backstory of this in the movie, but we learn in the books that the friend group of James, Sirius, Peter, and Remus, Remus was a werewolf. He was afflicted with this condition. And so in order to provide some solidarity, his friends became animagi and were able to transform into animals in order to, you know, be together and work through Remus's cycles of being a werewolf. So Sirius transforms into a shaggy black dog, which we see, you know, echoed in a bunch of imagery before we actually meet Sirius. We see the black dog in the clouds. We see the black dog in the bottom of the teacup in the first divination class. And the black dog is a huge motif in British folklore, as our UK listeners will certainly know. There are almost as many variations on the black dog in British folklore as there are like provinces or towns in the British Isles. There is so much localized folklore around this. And that's one of the reasons I want to bring this in as a counterpart to the werewolf, because in itself, it shows us the kind of dueling nature of the dog symbolism. So when you think of a dog, like when you think about walking through the forest and a big black shaggy dog appearing and having maybe some red eyes and those glowing at you through the woods, what is your first instinct, Derek?
I'm going to be eaten by the big bad wolf.
I'm going to be mauled by this thing. This thing is uncontrolled. It's out in the wilderness. It's feral. Like, it's going to get me. It could attack me. But say you're walking through the woods and you see like a kindly English chap with a newsboy cap, and he's got a big English hound dog with him that is maybe a little black and shaggy, but is overall like panting and frolicking. What is your first instinct when you see that?
Oh, let's go play.
Can I pet the doggy, right? Yeah, like there's this dueling nature of fear and also like incredible love that comes with the dog archetype. And Sirius tells this to us after we have seen him multiple times being an aggressive figure, the dog, you know, dragging Ron down through the tunnel into the Whomping Willow through to the Shrieking Shack. Then we'll talk to Sirius and he'll be like, sorry about that. Normally I have a very sweet disposition as a dog. And that's something that we see in this folklore of the black dog in the British Isles. The walking of this line between the fearsome hell beast and the loyal companion, those two aspects that we think of in the dog that are present in the dog. There is an inner wolf nature, but there is also the dog curled up by the hearth, the one who protects your home. So some of the more like famous versions of this black dog are Black Shuck, who usually appears around East Anglia, who was a hell beast and mauled a bunch of churches in the 16th century before returning to hell.
Oh man, can we adopt him?
Yeah, absolutely. Black Shuck, come and live with us. That's fine. We're about to have a baby, whatever. And is often associated with being a death omen. So if you see Black Shuck, you're probably expected to die within the year. There's also one known as Padfoot, which is part of the folklore of West Yorkshire. And he gets his name because he's sometimes invisible, but you'll at least hear his feet padding behind you or beside you. And then there is the Church Grim, which we get Professor Trelawney calling the black dog image the Grim. The Church Grim comes from English and Scandinavian folklore and usually guards and protects churchyards and can either be this death omen or can be this kind of benevolent guard of this sacred place and a judge of souls. It will decide whether you go to heaven or to hell.
So, wow.
Yeah, so all of these different variations on the black dog either have this like hell beast aspect or can be a little bit more ambiguous, can be a hellhound or can either be a protector.
You know, one interesting thing that happens in Azkaban is the reappropriation and the recalibration of the symbolism of the monster and of doom. So we have the werewolf, a monster who is a threat, who would kill their best friend, manifesting out of the best defense against the dark arts teacher we've seen, the best mentor for Harry that we've seen, and arguably the best of the entire series. Certainly, I argued that in our previous episode, and I stand by that stance. We have the Grim, we have the Black Dog, these symbols of monsters, these portents of dooms, the sackers of churches, the harbingers of hell itself. And we recalibrate these into our heroes, and they become the allies and protectors of Harry. Meanwhile, the very things that are actually dangerous to our heroes, and before I do that too, Buckbeak, an actual teaching monsters to children who becomes kind and ends up protecting and helping our heroes. And then you have the actual threats to our heroes, which are the institutionalized forms of power. The Malfoys threatening to kill Buckbeak, the Minister of Magic deploying Dementors at a school and potentially harming Harry Potter in their pursuit of an innocent man. You know, so you have this what's really actually bad are not these monsters, these things we think of as monstrous, these things that we say are portents of doom, but rather it's those who are misusing power and wielding it in either stupid or unenlightened or selfish or cruel ways that ends up being in the way of our heroes.
Yeah, there's a kind of civilized, uncivilized dichotomy that's happening where you think that the Minister of Magic and the Ministry are going to have your best interests in mind, but they're the first to deploy this like ultimate evil on the grounds with children. Whereas the Shrieking Shack of all places becomes a haven where friends are brought back together and the truth is revealed. A werewolf becomes the one who teaches you the greatest inner strength. Again, you know, we come back to the direction of Alfonso Cuarón and the sort of choppiness and roughness that he introduces and the darkness that he introduces to the wizarding world and the Hogwarts grounds and Hogsmeade. Those things become inherently more protective, better hiding places, and better for the development of the characters than the pristine minister and his ministry.
The werewolf teaches Harry Potter to find his inner innate joy and to channel that into guardian and guiding and healing light that can literally banish the wraiths that are sucking the soul of our hero.
So this is the last piece of animal magic that I wanted to discuss too. So great segue there. The Patronus. We have these varying degrees of abstraction when it comes to the role of animals within the story. We have two forms of magic that involve literal transformation into animals. And then we have the conjuring of the Patronus, which is the new piece of magic that we're introduced to within this story. Harry learns to conjure a Patronus charm in order to protect him from the Dementors. And he has to do this by summoning his happiest memory in order to banish the darkness with as much light as he can muster. Again, that conflict of darkness and light. And while at first his Patronus only manifests as a sort of beam of silvery light that creates a sort of protective shield, once it's matured, it becomes a stag. And we will learn later that everyone has a unique animal or creature that is associated with their Patronus that will become their patron, if you will. It's animal magic or animal energy used to express the inner self, to conjure the strongest and most powerful, most positive version of the inner self. It's got a lot of similarity with what we would call a familiar or familiar spirits in the magical tradition, or we might call it a spirit or totem animal in line with some of indigenous culture. And if you read His Dark Materials, it's like a daemon, a person's inner self expressed through an animal. We find descriptions of familiars and familiar spirits used in magic in texts dating back to mostly the Middle Ages and the early Renaissance. And these are supernatural beings that assist witches and wizards in their magic. They're often described as being able to manifest in animal form. So they're not animals by nature, but that's how they will present to the outside world. The most recognizable example of this is, of course, the black cat as the witch's familiar. Familiars can serve the magic user in a protective capacity, as a messenger, as an emissary, a servant, a gatherer of information, or in various other assistant capacities. And they're sort of similar to an older tradition known as tutelary deities. That's a really widespread concept that's kind of everywhere in every culture. These protective spirits, guardians or patrons that can sometimes take the form of an animal and are associated either with a person or a particular place. In terms of discovering your familiar, you might meet them by chance, like you might encounter them in a wood somewhere, and they may pledge their service to you, or you might even inherit a familiar spirit from a family member if you are being passed the knowledge of magic. And when we think of a Patronus, we sort of see a similar method of discovery. It's an animal patron that is unique to each magic user, and it can be revealed in its true form spontaneously, aligning with the qualities of the wizard to reveal a similar animal, or there can be a hereditary aspect. Harry's Patronus is a stag, which we learn was also his father's animagus form. We don't necessarily get that from the movie, but we know this from the book. So he's inherited this animal to an extent. He's inherited his father's legacy. And the Patronus is used as this protective spirit, specifically to ward off Dementors. But later in the series, we'll see tons of ways in which the Patronus can be employed as a messenger, as an emissary, as a guide for others. So it will become this incredibly essential piece of Harry's magical equation, his understanding of himself as connected to this stag, or this stag as a manifestation of his better nature. And just to think of, you know, the symbolism of stags too, they're often in literature and mythology, they're the object of quests. They're this majestic, sort of elusive creature that you'll see in the woods. They are incredibly powerful, and they're, you know, you wouldn't want to cross one and get on its bad side, but they're inherently kind of benevolent and non-threatening. They're herbivorous, so they are set up as a really interesting contrast to the dogs, which are more carnivorous creatures. And so Harry and his father, James, are set up kind of as the temper to the dog nature of Sirius and Remus. Like, let's remember mercy. Let's remember that killing is not what this is all about. Let's remember our better nature.
Yeah, and through Harry interacting with Remus, he learns the value of life. He learns the value of protecting. He learns that his father's legacy and his mother's legacy is one of self-sacrifice and one of selflessness. And it's why in the climax, in the Shrieking Shack, he won't allow these two now mentors, his godfather and his teacher, to become murderers. He helps save their soul. And then this is mirrored, because everything has a mirror in in how he ends up saving both his past self, and he ends up saving Sirius, using the Patronus charm, which finally comes in its full magical stag-like form.
Yeah, wonderful. Yeah, I just love the kind of gradations of animal magic through this, how each of those symbols is employed and how we see the nature of the characters change based on their relationship to their animal.
Yeah, wonderful. Would you permit a pivot, or do you have more on this?
Absolutely, I would permit a pivot.
I think it is high time that we talk about some of the adult characters, their names, and their connection with Roman history and mythology.
What?
I think it is time, because at this point in the franchise, there's no mistaking that there are several links to Roman history and several links to Roman mythology within the characters' names. The first and most easiest would be Minerva McGonagall. Minerva is the Romanized form of Athena and is the name of a very important Roman goddess. And Minerva McGonagall, no surprise there. I'd also like to take a minute in Severus Snape. This one may not be as well known. So Severus is named after the Severan dynasty of Rome. The Severan dynasty took hold with the first Severan, which was Lucius Septimius Severus. If you go to Rome and go to the ancient forum, his triumphal arch is still standing to this day. Laurel and I have seen it.
Yeah.
And it is quite a sight to behold. And he ruled Rome from 193 to 211 of the Common Era, CE, or sometimes called AD. So Severus Snape is clearly named after the Severan dynasty. Now, there's a few more that I'd like to highlight, which I think will then come into the theme of why I think J.K. Rowling does this, besides the fact that she obviously knows her Roman history and mythology, and they sound cool. Two, we have Remus Lupin. This one is very interesting. So Rome's mythic founders were Romulus and Remus, two orphan brothers who were suckled by a she-wolf when they were children and without parents. And then they grew into adults. They founded the city of Rome, and then they famously fought each other for kingship. And Remus loses to Romulus, and Rome is born and named Rome after its founder, Romulus.
Rather than being called Reem after Remus.
Exactly.
The Reman Empire.
Doesn't have the same ring to it. And then Lupin, which is a manifestation of different Latin versions of wolf and lycanthropy, and in this respect, we can understand Remus Lupin's name as Wolf Wolf. That's literally what I think his name can be understood as.
Wolf John Wolf.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Because he is the werewolf. Lastly, I'd like to go to Sybil. And this is the one that I think is probably the most interesting in this movie. In the ancient world, starting in ancient Greece, there were prophets known as Sybils. Sybils, they existed in many different temples all over the ancient world, and they were renowned for their ability to channel the will of Apollo. And anyone who was in the ancient world was a good prophetor or a good oracle had to have some sort of connection to Apollo, as Apollo was the god who gave the prophecies. Apollo is sometimes symbolized as the sun, because the sun sees all, though he is not a god of the sun in the strictest form, but he is the god of prophecy. In the mythic founding of Rome, after the reign of Romulus, there were seven kings, and then eventually the Romans kicked out the kings and formed the Republic. The last king was said to be known as Tarquin. Now, Tarquin had an interaction with a Sybil who gave and offered to sell mounds of prophecies about Rome and her fate. And Tarquin, being an arrogant king, refused. So the Sybil started burning the pages. This started making Tarquin a little nervous that these prophecies might be lost. And down to just a few prophecies left, Tarquin finally relents and buys these prophecies. These prophecies existed in the libraries of Rome henceforth. People, emperors, would-be rulers, generals, in times of Rome's crisis, they would be brought out, and they were written almost like riddles to be deciphered, and they would try to figure out, what did this famous Sybil say? If you've read or watched the I, Claudius, we see Claudius going to a Sibyl and interacting with the generation of Sibyl prophecies who are intimately linked with the divination of Rome. And it is the Sibyls who would help if Hannibal was at the gates, if Caesar and Pompey are at war, if you've just been crowned emperor and you want to know who your enemies are, who your friends are, and where those two things overlap, you would go to a Sibyl and you would most likely get these sacred ancient prophecies. Now, other interesting facts, Rome was sacked several times and these prophecies were burned several times and rewritten from memory. So no one really knows if this ancient story is true. Most historians don't believe in the mythic founding of Rome and her seven kings. Most think it is just a pure mythic foundation to create a shared heritage. Nevertheless, Roman military, cultural, and economic hegemonic power was intimately linked with the Sibyl and the Sibyl's ability to prophesize about Rome. Now here we have a character named a Sibyl teaching divination to the students and making similar prophecies about what the rise of a military autocratic ruler who seeks to control the entire wizarding world. In this way, Rowling has reached through the mythic and historical foundations of Rome and recast Harry Potter as a new Rome, as a new version of Rome and her fortunes and fate. We are in a magical republic who will be under threat of a military autocratic imperial rule, one that is both destructive to freedom and destructive to diversity. And in this way, the Sibyl to me and the naming of the character Sibyl has so much interesting Roman roots in it that just can't be denied or ignored.
I think that's incredible. I had never heard that story before, so thank you for sharing that. It's also really fascinating that Professor Trelawney, Sibyl Trelawney, is set up very clearly as kind of a hack from the beginning. We see Hermione just like mercilessly making fun of her and her inability to even see like that there is a table in front of her. Like she can see the future, but she can't stop herself from tripping over a table. Like she's clearly not possessed of the kind of sight that she claims to be possessed of until, the final act when we see her go into a true trance, when we see her kind of leave her body and leave her own ego and channel some higher truth as though she's being fed the prophecy through a god or through Apollo or through some channel that she's able to involuntarily tap into. So it's not her. She's not the prophet. There's just prophecy being fed through her in ways that she's unable to control.
Well, and this is very true of how the Sibyls were said to have operated. These Sibyls were all women, 100% of them. You could not be a male Sibyl, and you would go into a trance and start speaking the will of Apollo, and that will would then be written down to be interpreted. And not every Sibyl was renowned for good prophecies. Some were considered to be better than others. Some were considered to have a stronger gift than others. Just as in when we see Sibyl Trelawney, not really a good diviner, but when it happens, it is true and it is a real prophecy. Furthermore, she is completely unaware when this occurs. She has no control over the gift and it comes like a trance. So the first known Sibyl was a Greek named Heraclitus in the 5th century BC. And it did it in a poem, and this is the line: "The Sibyl with frenzied mouth uttering things not to be laughed at, unadorned and unperfumed, yet reaches to 1,000 years with her voice by the aid of gods."
I love that, the line unadorned and unperfumed, too, because when we look at that versus Sibyl Trelawney, she has been so wrapped up in the trappings of what it means to be a prophet, of what it means to have the skills of divination, that usually her room, her classroom is like heavily incensed. She wears tons of shawls and beads. There is a Christmas tree made out of teacups in her room. Like, she is absolutely adorned and perfumed because she's trying to project this image of being a prophet, of having access to this like very new agey kind of inspired magic. But then when we get the genuine magic from her, it is unadorned and unperfumed. So I think that's a really cool quote to pull out. You know, something that we learn later about Professor Trelawney in the books is that her grandmother was the great Cassandra Trelawney, who was an incredibly well-respected prophet and diviner. And Cassandra, of course, we've talked about numerous times, has that as a name, has very, very deep connections to prophecy and also misunderstood prophecy, especially.
So the word divination is it's derived from Latin divinare, which means to foresee, to foretell, to predict, to prophesy, which has another related word, divinus, which is now we call the word divine. And the idea of the divine and divination are intimately linked linguistically and mythologically, because if you are able to practice divination, it is inherently a divine act. It is channeling the will of the gods or God. Divination has ancient roots in our own world, and those roots are deep, and they have existed for a long time. In fact, divination was so common and so practiced in so many areas and cultures that it's been hard for Western European enlightenment to actually purge it from our society even to this day. And it wasn't until the Western European enlightenment that said, no, these superstitions are wrong. It is impossible to tell the future. And in fact, most of the diviners that have existed throughout both the ancient into the medieval and then into the modern world have been charlatans, have been preying on people who are sad or weak or lonely and trying to give them fortunes in order to make them feel better. And in Enlightenment discourse, they started seeing this as superstition and started arguing against it. And divination got more or less purged, in particular, from our religious and political institutions. But previous to that, they were commonplace. Now this brings us to Hermione and her reaction to divination. Hermione, who represents, in particular, in this installment of Harry Potter, the institutionalized form of magical knowledge. She is a product of Enlightenment principles. Magic is governed by certain rules. These rules have, they can be taught, and then from there you can channel that into action. She applies magic judiciously and scientifically. When she first interacts with divination, a relic of the ancient world, she laughs at it as a non-scientific form of magic, which I know that sounds paradoxical, a scientific form of magic, but in the Harry Potter world, these things are not paradoxical. That is what Hermione does, right?
Yeah, there is magical theory. There are principles. There are laws, just as there are in chemistry and biology.
Even when Hermione gets the time turner and is able to manipulate the physical laws of time, she tells Harry these are the strict guidelines that we must abide by in order to not mess with time, or it will mess back with us. And so because of her representing that enlightenment, Western European enlightenment, she rejects divination outright. And what we see in this is a conflict between what people know of magic to be true versus the ancient and primal roots of magic that don't necessarily jive with these modern institutionalized rules. This theme going forward is going to be unpacked again and again in Harry Potter as we start to wonder, how prophetic are prophecies? How set in stone is the future? If Harry and Potter can use a time turner to change the past, is there some sort of mechanism to then change the future, which is going to go down to, do these wizards, and by extension, do we, the fans of Harry Potter, have free will? And this movie is interjecting that theme for the first time through the conflict of Hermione, Enlightenment, individualism, free will, academic institutions, and Trelawney, divine-inspired prophecy, ancient magic that defies explanation and law.
That's excellent. It really is excellent because it's so intertwined with like the deepest themes of Harry Potter, which are very much enlightenment themes, like the power of the individual and choice and human will being the most incredible forms of magic that you really can't contend with the old stuff. And think about what we've seen so far in the kind of undermining or the destruction of the symbols of ancient and medieval magic. The way we've seen the destruction of the Sorcerer's Stone, the symbol of alchemy, in order to bring about a more enlightened and logical understanding of magic. The destruction of the basilisk, also a symbol of alchemy, but a symbol of the deep and centuries-old roots of discrimination that underlie the education system at Hogwarts. And then in this one, we start to see the undermining of divination and prophecy, this ancient form of magic, in favor of logic, in favor of reason, in favor of mercy, in favor of, again, the power of love and memory and inner light and the power of the individual and their will.
Totally agree. And, you know, just to cycle back to the names, ancient Rome calls out through J.K. Rowling's Harry Potter series, and it's not by accident. And I think it starts with Severus Snape, Minerva McGonagall, just because those really sound cool and they sound like they're from ancient Rome because they are. But then in Remus Lupin, we see a real link to the theme of that character in the name. And then in Sybil Trelawney, we get, I think, the creme de la creme of symbols of the ancient world manifesting in a character and driving the themes of prophecy versus free will, which are going to be put in place by Harry Potter going forward. One of the most major themes of, does anyone actually have any choice, or was this all preordained?
Yeah, excellent.
What else you got?
Just here at the end, I want to meditate on how the story ends. We obviously have the escape of Buckbeak and of Sirius from imprisonment. They are now free again, but still fugitives. And Harry reflects with Professor Lupin, who has been pretty much forced to resign and is being removed from his post, even though he's the best defense against the dark arts teacher that Hogwarts has seen in these many years. Harry says, none of it made any difference. And he expresses this incredible frustration with the fact that the system didn't change. Nobody left this, understanding that Sirius was innocent. We didn't get the triumphant procession that we usually get, the applause or the banners of Gryffindor that we usually get at the end of this movie. Instead, we get Harry's first experience of futility. And I think this is a deeply important shift for the series because the wins are going to stop feeling like wins for the most part. Even when there are triumphs, they are going to be very, very bittersweet. And things are going to get a lot darker for Harry before they get better. And I mean, he couldn't have a better cohort of friends to usher him through. He couldn't have a better team than Ron and Hermione to continue keeping his head up. He couldn't have a better team of mentors than Sirius and Remus and Hagrid and Dumbledore and Minerva to help him continue to find his inner light. Because as Dumbledore says, happiness can be found even in the darkest of times if one only remembers to turn on the light. So Harry will not stop experiencing the sense of futility. He will not stop experiencing disappointment from here on out, but he will be better equipped to find that light within himself.
And until next time, everyone, be kind.
Expecto Patronum.